Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what? If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save an astronomical 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedroom!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes death is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi, and I am here to introduce you to a very special extra bonus episode of the KingCast in which Bresnikan and I sit down with one Mr. Michael Flanagan to talk about the life of Chuck. Now, forgive us for being a little self-centered with this chat you're about to listen to, but the wampler of it all is a bit overwhelming for us and for Mike himself as well. There may be some tears, but just like the life of Chuck tells us, there's also joy to be had in this world too. So this one might be a little bit of a roller coaster of emotions for the longtime KingCast listeners, as there's a lot of talk about Scott. And, you know, it just so happened that the time that we sat down and talked with Mike was on the exact 1 year anniversary of his death. And so that was weighing on all of us as we were going into this chat. But you know, it's not all of a bummer. I swear to God, you won't be sitting there bummed out the whole time. We also have some fun as well. That's how we do here at the KingCast. So enjoy this extra episode this week. And without further ado, let's jump into our chat with Mike Flanagan.
Hey guys,
what how up? I'm just gathering everybody that you've ever podcasted with before.
I love it.
This is your podcast life.
But I have to just right off the bat, it's just really good to see your faces today, especially.
Yeah, no, that's I was gonna tear the band-aid right off, but then I was while I was sitting in the waiting room, I saw Mike Ryan had just tweeted about having an emotional talk about Wampler with you on the press day. So I imagine you're probably hearing from, you know, a lot of people today.
Oh yeah, it started in earnest yesterday.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been really nice because it's kind of run the gamut between there's been tears from me, from other people, and there's been like a lot of joy too. Yeah. So, you know, and talking to Mike Ryan earlier, like he was kind of there, which it was a good way to kind of kick it off today, because I was very aware of it going into the day of like, this could be hard.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to, you know, start it off essentially talking about that because, you know, it was exactly a year ago. You know, something I wanted to say was that you happened to be in Austin, you know, this, when this happened, and you, graciously took me out to dinner that evening. We had a little cry, a little cope. And I've told many friends and listeners of the show that have asked about, like, you know, my state of mind and all this. I've told them the story before, but in my reaction to it. But I wanted to tell you directly, Mike, just how much that meant and how much I needed that at that point in the day. And it was, you know, it's something I think about, and it makes me smile. And the only thing that probably makes me smile from that day was, you know, the world was going crazy, and you kind of helped pull me out of the cyclone and into the eye of the grief. And we could sit there and talk about it and just have a quiet conversation at a cheesy Tex-Mex place that I love to death that happens to also be the restaurant that I pitched Scott the KingCast in when I told him I wanted to come on the show or wanted to.
Is that right?
So thank you for that, Mike. And we are recording now, and this will be in there for posterity. So I want everybody to know just what a good guy Mike Flanagan is. So.
That's not what I heard, but okay, we'll let you have that. That was the same. Look, okay, so think about the synchronicity of all of this. Yeah. The same restaurant where you pitch Scott the show. Years later, that's where you and Mike go to sit down on the night that he dies. A year later, here the three of us are talking by coincidence about the life of Chuck.
Unless, Mike, did you arrange this press day to happen exactly on the
Is this the Scott Wampler commemorative press junket? Like,
look, no one is better at marketing than Neon, and they've really gone out of their way this time.
But this movie is about synchronicity and coincidences and taking advantage of opportunities. But sometimes the universe also guides you together, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It's, you know, there are those moments in life that feel just too bizarrely too symmetrical. And this certainly has that feeling as you know, people right as we speak and for the last couple of weeks have been seeing, you know, Wampler and you, Eric, you know, on this huge screen behind Tom Hiddleston as this movie introduces itself into the world. And I still imagining, you know, thinking back to being on set with you guys and imagining that title card coming up at the end of this movie is just, it's insane to me, but yeah, it does. There's an incredible synchronicity to it that does challenge my hard-fought atheism sometimes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can also kind of pair it, not to make this whole conversation a bummer, but you can also pair it with kind of to me, it's one of the saddest lingering things about Scott being gone is that he never got to see the movie. And this is something I know I can tell you how proud he was to have been a part of it. Like the smiles that he had, you know, when you didn't just come back with our, cause we have, you know, the vocal cameos, the voice cameos at the beginning as well that, you know, I think half of them expected you to go, oh, I fucked up. I shouldn't have asked these non-actors to come in and read all this dialogue.
What have I done?
And you know, when you watch the movie, and here's the thing is watching the movie, I know that Scott would have been so chuffed, and he read the script, he knew how it played out, but like just how, you know, it's not just that Karen Gillan sitting there listening to us talk about the end of the world, it's how then in the next scene she goes and she's repeating what we just said to other stuff, and I know that he probably just would have had a little smirk, you know, maybe got a little red up in the scalp, a little embarrassment but also pride, you know, going up to the Mohawk, you know. You know, and it's a bummer. And I have very few regrets when it comes to Scott and my 5 years working with him. And one of them is that I didn't push harder, because you showed me the movie when, like last year, when I went out to Ella's in LA in February for my birthday of last year. And I tried really hard to get Scott to come with me. And he essentially was like, nah, like I'll see it. And, you know, and that's kind of a lesson to take away. You know, it's like, if it's something that you think you want to do it, you know, because you're nobody's guaranteed a next week or a next month or next year.
Yeah, that's something to be mad at him about, actually. I think Wampler's personality would have allowed us to give him a little bit of shit for that.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You should have said yes, Scott. Yeah. You know, but
well, that motherfucker hated traveling more than anybody I've ever met in my life.
Something he has in common with Steve, right? Is that Stephen King hates to travel too. Those two guys would have hung back together.
So let's, you know, let's talk about the dedication. You know, I think that, you know, this is something you said that you wanted to do that evening 1 year ago today. And I think we were standing out front of that Chewy's when you got a text back from your producers going, you know, okay, yeah, whatever you need. Yeah. Cause you told me then it's like, we're going to dedicate the movie to Scott. So what's the process like? And can you talk a little bit about what a movie like Life of Chuck, what the themes are and all that stuff, to have a dedication on it, to me that means more, you know, than a dedication on like Transformers 5 or something, you know what I mean?
It's a story about someone who died too young. Yeah. And about someone who had more of an impact on others' lives than they might have realized, and whose life was impacted by others more in a more profound way than anyone realized. And I think you know, again, the symmetry is upsetting, but beautiful. In a story that basically is saying, you never know if you have a tomorrow, you never know when the whole universe can end and the end of one person is the end of a universe, to then, I mean, I can't imagine a more appropriate project to dedicate to Wampler. Thematically, it of course is a little too close to home on all fronts. It's one of those things that just felt necessary and right in the moment a year ago. And there's something I've felt it. I've watched this movie so many hundreds of times since then in various capacities, evaluating a mix or looking at the final credit crawl for spelling errors and kind of all the mundane stuff we do as you finish a movie and you kind of put it out there. But I've yet to kind of experience that dedication without an emotional moment, which is, you know, saturation when it comes to watching a movie this often. When you work on it, it becomes impossible to still see it. You don't have an emotional reaction to anything anymore. But I still, whenever I see him, that scene at the fountain, I don't know exactly what is said in the voiceover, because no matter how many times I've seen it, I'm always kind of pulled into this moment when I see you guys back there and thinking back to the day and thinking back to what it was like on set. And then it just starts the dominoes falling through the years, you know? So yeah, it felt like exactly the right thing. And it's an honor, an unfortunate honor that he's part of this particular story.
Right. So, yeah. Yeah. Obviously we'd prefer if he was just excited to do our live KingCast show here at the Alamo, you know,
right,
to celebrate the movie. But like you said, there is an odd symmetry to it, and knowing how proud he was of this, and how, like, you know, we had conversations. We weren't the kind to really talk too deeply, you know, outside of the show. Like, we talk more deeply on air than we did in person usually. But you know, but he was like super psyched about it. Like, he was just so happy, you know, to have been invited to play along, to, you know, have the voice cameo, to show up in the movie. You know, he wasn't used to that kind of stuff. And I mean, as you could tell when he had to go to you on set and say, I don't want to wear the shit that your costumer's trying to put me in.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm just going to wear my shirt. And you're like, okay, I don't care.
You know, what were you trying to put him in, Mike? Was it some sort of jester outfit?
my memory is that it was this kind of, and I wrote about this in the Fangoria piece, that it's like it was kind of this like muumuu-ish thing that they found that was like skin tight on him. And there's a reason why he's standing up in the cameo, by the way. It's me and my now fiance, Kelsey, sitting on the lip of the fountain, and Wobbler standing talking to us. And the reason why he's standing is because he didn't want to sit down and have his gut show up as prominently on the thing. I'm like, I know I'm fat. I don't mind if people see my gut while I'm sitting down. It's totally fine. But yeah, I think he had a little vanity to him, which is something that's really funny. But I don't want to make this all about the bummer of losing Scott. We've already made the first half of this.
No, but before we move on from it, can I add something?
Sure, please do.
And I want to share something with you guys. And I just pulled this up now. I have not looked at it since April of 2024. But these are the last messages I shared with Scott. And I had messaged him, so Mayor of Door City on Instagram, I'd messaged him about the Keith Gordon episode you did. I love Keith Gordon. Mm. So I was like geeking out with him about that. And he wrote to me a little about that. And then he said, but BTW, I was rewatching Fall of the House of Usher yesterday, probably the third or fourth time. And so in the House of Usher, I don't have a cameo in Life of Chuck, but Mike slipped a reference to me in a House of Usher when Kate's character, the publicist, says, get Bresnikan on the phone from Vanity Fair, which I heard about from you, Eric. You were like, hey, have you seen House of Usher? I'm like, I just got the screeners. And you were like, you should watch it right away. And and we did, and my wife and I were totally surprised to get that little shout out. And then I sent Mike a message saying, you know, you devil, like, what a cool thing. Thank you so much. And Mike, do you remember what you told me? You were like, oh, I kind of wanted to send the video to you like a year ago when we shot it, but I thought it would be a surprise. So I did the same thing. I never posted about it or told anybody about that because it was so fun hearing from friends as they discovered the show. So anyway, that's the background. But he says, by the way, I was watching House of the Usher probably third or fourth time. And when Kate is like, get in touch with Bresnahan at Vanity Fair, it delights me every time. So I wrote back, that was such a fun surprise. The best part, again, hearing from friends these past few months as they discovered it. I never had anything like that happen before, so it's been a treat. And Scott writes back, it was awesome. And this is when I found out about the Life of Chuck thing. He goes, and I think Vespi and I will be getting a taste of that type of unreality soon. We ended up in the Life of Chuck! Exclamation points. No way, says I. Rock on. Yeah, we visited the set for a few days, and he put us in behind Hiddleston in a shot, and we have a vocal cameo as two NPR hosts earlier in the movie. I have never been drafted for something along these lines, and I'm extremely nervous about the whole thing. And so he basically suggests that thing that actors feel, which is that they can't watch themselves on screen. You know, that's a very common thing. So he says, Vespi went out to LA last month and watched the movie with Mike and said that the parts where we briefly appeared pulled him right the fuck out of the movie. Just shattered the illusion.
Which is a goddamn dirty lie. I never said that. But yeah.
He said, he's this is the part that this is the part that just got me. Again, I have not read this. I can't wait to see it, but I'm gonna close my eyes during the background thing. Well, he did. But anyway, that was his, he was pumped for it, and you gave him a great gift, even if he didn't get to see it. Hey man, Moses didn't get to make it to the land of milk and honey either, but he got to know it was there, you know, he got to see it from the mountaintop. So
That is a very
not
lovely thing to say, and one way to be the first person to bust your nuts like 3 ways to Sunday for being taken that so seriously.
comparing him to Moses
Right.
or the well, fuck you, Scott.
Yeah.
I just think it's a nice thing. It's a You know, you gave these two guys a little bit of immortality there, Mike. You know, and that's a fun thing. So, okay, now let's move on from bringing it down.
Right. Well, I did want to say that there's also, you talked about the synchronicity and the weird, like, I don't know, circle backness of it all. Somebody, one of the listeners pointed out right around the time that it was announced that you were doing Life of Chuck that, like, oh, Mike said he wanted to do this in at the Banger in Bangor. And I had totally forgotten, and I went back and re-listened to it, and indeed somebody asks you when you did that live show with us in Bangor, asked you like what other, you know, you're kind of known for adapting the unadaptable Stephen King thing, like what other Stephen King stuff would you want to do? And you said The Life of Chuck, and the reaction from everybody, ourselves included, is like, how the fuck do you make that a movie? So it is really, you know, it is does feel a little full circle here that you like probably the first time you publicly talked about it was with Scott and I, you know, on stage, and now here we are, you know,
I
on
mean,
the
that
front.
was Steve. That was Stephen King's response, wasn't it, Mike? Didn't you tell me he wrote you back and was like, really? You think this is a movie? I
Really?
don't
That's the one?
know.
Yeah. No, it's you know, it's not the most obvious movie, I guess.
Yeah, no.
But it really, from the jump for me, the movie that played in my head when I read it seemed really clear and kind of great. And my whole thing was, is there any way to just get that out of there and put it on a screen? But no, it never felt obvious. And I think there was a lot of we never could have made it if we had a studio. I mean, it was nobody would have bought it. So I'm just
Right.
really lucky that we got a chance to do it at all.
This might be a little too inside baseball, but you know, when you're building up an independent movie like this, was it getting somebody like Tom on board that made it a reality? You have to get that big name actor. Is that what?
Yes, you know, there was a certain amount that they thought it's all based on what's called international pre-sales.
Right.
Like they sell the right to distribute the movie before the movie's made, and for that you need the eventual distributors to have confidence that people will see it and want to see it. And so apparently, my name doesn't get you there at all.
Did you tell them that Eric Vespe and Scott Wampler might have cameos in it? Did that move the needle? We're really big in Uruguay. So.
Yeah, they were like, oh, King cast. Well, yeah, by all means. But even if you add Stephen King, it doesn't move the needle enough by himself.
Okay.
And that's, I think, because of the wild kind of swings in quality that, you know, adaptations get with his name on it.
Right.
And so, yeah, they want you to kind of, who's the name on the poster that people will come see? And so my initial gut on it was, what if Chuck was a complete unknown? Was somebody we'd never seen before? So that we're all like, who is this guy? But then I saw Tom dancing on Graham Norton, and it was like, oh, no, this will be great. He was the first to sign on, and that did move the needle. And kind of as all the other main cast would sign on to it, the financing becomes more and more of a reality. But you're out on a limb at the beginning. Like, the thing could just never happen. Even with Tom attached, you have to call up and be like, we couldn't get the financing. It happens all the time. And I think by the time it was Tom, Chiwetel, Karen, all kind of made it real. And by the time Hamill signed on, it was like, all right, we're okay.
Yeah, nice. Well, you talk about the cast. One thing that's really interesting to me is that, you know, you're one of those filmmakers, you know, we've jokingly called your troupe the Flavengers, but it's like, you know, you have a core group of actors you like working with. And I have to imagine that, like, when you're sitting writing The Life of Chuck out, and I also seem to remember you said you kind of wrote this over a weekend, you turned this around like real quick.
Yeah.
Did you know then that, like, oh, this is a perfect, just the way that it's structured, the way, without giving anything away for anybody who hasn't, you know, seen it, the way that there can be a face at the beginning that comes into play later, or vice versa, that this would be a great vehicle for you to essentially just open up the doors to all your favorite friends and collaborators and stuff to come in? And because you probably have more Flavengers in this movie than you have even in, like, you know, a 10 episode, you know, streaming.
I don't know. Something, Midnight Mass has a lot of Flavengers in it. So,
yeah. I think technically the Usher has the most.
Oh, yeah, maybe at that. Yeah, probably.
But you're totally right. And the whole time I was like, oh, it's a kaleidoscopic ensemble. There's really no protagonist,
right.
You know, it hands off. It's a relay race. And so, yeah, it was clear that, oh, this would be great. Even if I have people for just one scene, you know, just one half day on production, it's a great way to kind of build this kaleidoscope of characters. But yeah, it was always going to be, we didn't have money. So I'd also have to be calling in favors, and it's like my Flavengers are going to show up for scale for half a day. I thought, you know, more than the uninitiated.
Right.
But, on the other hand, I was shocked that it's like, you know, Matthew Lillard, I'd never worked with him before. Mm-hmm. He was like, yeah, half a day scale. Sure. You know, Dave Desmalchin, same thing. Harvey Guillen, like Nick Offerman, came in at an insulting discount to what he's typically accustomed to making on a thing. And he also came in for scale and did it just because he loved the story. The King's story did a lot of the work in convincing people to come and be a part of it, because it was just so unusual.
Right.
Nick Offerman is the voice of the movie, the narrator of the movie. And you really use that character, if we can call him a character, as the voice of King's narration. That's a way of getting King's writing into the movie, his description. Did you ever think about having King do that?
It did cross my mind, to be honest, because I love the audiobooks that he reads himself. You know, I think the first one I ever listened to that he read was 1408 in the Blood and Smoke collection.
Yeah, that's the first one I heard too.
It's so good. It's my preferred way to experience that story. And even down to, you know, LT's Theory of Pets was put out as that live performance that he did with a crowd. It's incredible. That had absolutely crossed my mind. When Offerman was on the table, though, it was one of those rare moments where kind of everybody agreed that it's like, oh, Nick Offerman as the voice of this movie is kind of amazing. And what he's able to do with King's prose, and where he's able to, because he has an emotional arc in his performance vocally.
Yeah.
You know, what he's able to do there, I think, ended up being a real gift to the movie. But yeah, it would have been neat to hear Steve do it too, for sure.
I think it's a great merger too, because Nick's whole thing, I mean, he plays a lot of different characters, especially now, but that whole everyman, like
Yeah.
He makes
guy's
stuff
guy,
with his hands.
woodworking guy. That's Steve's vibe too, is he's an artist. They're both artists, but like Steve is a laundry worker at heart, you know, like he's a school teacher at heart. He's an everyman, and that's why people connect with him, because he doesn't talk down to you. He talks to you man to man or man to woman or whatever, you know. And I think that's a good merger of Offerman and his voice.
It does. It strikes at that kind of everyman. You're exactly right. It strikes at the everyman quality Steve inherently is speaking from. And it takes the pretension out of it in a way that, you know, because we would joke. It's like, is this the, you know, is this the Attenborough narration, which is going to feel way too haughty, way too heady? You know, we had talked about like, oh, the Helen Mirren version of it, kind of before we saw Barbie and saw like, you know, at one point it was like Sigourney Weaver, and it's like basically anyone who's narrated Planet Earth. Like we could no one felt right, and it felt at a certain point that having the wrong narrator, having the wrong kind of voice associated with it, would actually alienate the viewer. And VO's narration's hard; like it can knock you right out. You don't always get, you know, Morgan Freeman in Shawshank, where it's just so perfect that it carries you. But yeah, I love what Nick did, and once we kind of hit on that, he pre-recorded it in his car for us, so that we could play it on set. And he was like, "My cadence is pretty distinct. The actors may appreciate knowing that I'm speaking more slowly than they may anticipate." And like having that guide track helped, you know, a ton. And it just lifted the morality of the cast to hear Nick Offerman. But yeah, I love what he does. I love what he does with it.
It does
Funny
make you
man Mike
wish.
Flanagan here with the voice, the impressions.
I know, that's pretty
That's a
good.
pretty good Offerman.
Pretty good. It does make me want to see Offerman in a Stephen King thing. Like, I feel like he would be like a great Sheriff Bannerman, or what's his nuts? The other sheriff from Castle Rock that's in Needful Things. And I run a Stephen King show. Believe
Pangborn.
Bang
Oh,
Pangborn.
Alan
Gotcha.
Pangborn.
Yeah, his successor. It's a yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think he could rule in the Stephen King thing. And speaking
Or
of,
he'd be a great Buster Keaton from Needful Things too, is
oh
the
my,
town, the
oh,
fucked up town selectman. Like, I'd like to see him, you know, kind of wired too with that
or
voice.
or may I be so bold, a Stephen DeShane perhaps for somebody who might or might not be working on a Dark Tower series. So I know that that you don't want to talk about much, but the KingCast listeners will kill me if I don't get
Of
an
course.
update from you on Dark
Oh,
Tower. So
I
tell us what
expect
you can. Tell us
it.
what tell us what you can, and then tell me more after we stop recording.
Of course. I know it looks like no progress, but that is not true. No, it's all moving forward. It's moving at the only pace this thing can move at, and it's just because it weighs so damn much. And kind of not to get too boring about it, we've talked about it a little bit, but just the rights situation with this story, because it covers so many other things that are owned by so many other people, pulling it all in and negotiating that stuff literally can take more than a year just with the lawyers. So like it's moving at the pace, the fastest it can. I can tell you that hasn't stopped me from working on the scripts, from you know, discussing casting and other logistical things, and kind of getting that and all lined up. The scripts are, I'm really pleased with. Steve is really pleased with them, which is to me kind of the ball game. So yeah, it's doing its thing. I know every time I announce a new project, or even if I'm just like, here's the trailer for Chuck, there's a percentage of the comments that are just like, what the fuck are you doing? Where's the Dark Tower?
Yeah, stop working on this other
And
shit.
yeah, it's like, knock it off. And it's like, guys, I have to make a living too. If I sat and waited for the tower to be up and running, I wouldn't be able to pay my bills anymore. You know, like, I've got to keep moving.
Why are
But
fans
I'm
so
working on it all
disres-
the time. Yeah.
Why are they so disrespectful, man? You've given them so much. It's like, back to work, you. Like,
I know, it really is. It's like, enough of this bullshit. Get back to the tower. But I agree. Like, there's never a period of time that goes by more than a month where I'm not like, I need to be working on the Dark Tower. So I always am. It's an oil tanker, and it takes a real long time to get started. But
Can you explain a little more? I think Eric and I understand what you're talking about, and a lot of the sort of deep-rooted fans will as well. But the way the Dark Tower extends into the broader Stephen King universe, it's not just the, what is it, seven novels and some short stories. It's Insomnia has aspects of the Crimson King. Are you aiming for completism, or do you have to shed some of that? Like just we can't pull Insomnia into this, or I don't know. Eric, what are some examples of
Insomnia.
other things?
Oh, well,
Pulling
Randall Flagg
Insomnia
being the big
in,
one, yeah, but yeah.
yeah, Randall Flagg,
Flagg, you
right?
have to, and there's others where it's just like, okay, you have to get into, Father Callahan. Like that's not negotiable, which means you're going to Warner Brothers because they've got Salem's Lot.
Salem's Lot.
So, you got to talk to them. Crimson King is actually a whole different thing because there's a history of adaptation with Hearts in Atlantis, which pulls in all sorts of stuff based on that deal that shouldn't have been pulled in because it's not in the movie,
Yeah,
but
it's
it's
cut
in
out of
the
the movie. They
story.
cut the they extended that out of this. They cut that out of the
There's
story.
no low
So
men in yellow coats in that one, but
exactly. However, Low Men in Yellow Coats, also you got to go to Warner Brothers because when they optioned the story, that was included, whether they put it in the movie or not. So there's all sorts of stuff. I'm aiming for something. It can't be what's in the book. It's not logistically possible. And I think to the cinematic audience, they're not going to pick up on insomnia the way the constant readers are. So it's like, okay, how do you deal with what you need from that as a character with psychic ability, who's going to be brought in as one of the breakers, and it's going to be really important how you deal with that. What are the other characters in the King universe that could fulfill a role like that and get the fans excited, even though you're changing it? And that puts you into the like, oh, I mean, for me, I'm like, what about Abra Stone? What about when you go into the what if you can't get Father Callahan, which is always the thing that comes up, and I think we can, but it's like, what if you can't? It's like, okay, well, who can fill that role? Who's a character who was presumed dead in another king, in another king story, who can come into this story and have a similar arc, of redemption? Do you go to Dick Halloran? I'm just saying, like, what do you do here? How do you make it so that the King fans will lean forward, and be excited about this particular change, but that people who haven't read the books and are being introduced to this connected universe will be able to recognize it from their cinematic experience? And that's part of what makes this thing so goddamn hard to do. And like the most of those decisions don't have to play in for the first couple seasons too. So like luckily the gift of the Dark Tower is if you do it right and you start at the beginning, you're dealing with one character following another character in a barren wasteland that where there's not even a structure to distract you. It is one person following another person. And
Very
everything
simple.
else, yeah, it's very simple. And everything is added. And it's added at the right cadence so that you're meeting new characters and the world is expanding. So that by the time you're arguing about like what to do with Father Callahan and to what extent, the Emerald City is going to come into play, by then, you've already built enough of this that the audience is with you, regardless of their familiarity with the source material. But that's what makes it so goddamn challenging to do.
But it's also going to be the thing that make if you guys
Makes
can
it
pull it
fun.
off, it's going to make it an all-timer,
Oh, it'd
and
be
so,
incredible. But yeah, and you
What
have to do
about
it. Yeah.
on top of that, simple problems to solve, like getting the rights to
Yeah.
Beatles
No, I mean, if because
songs,
if you walk into Tull and it's not, "Hey Jude, what are you doing?" And that's not the thing that you should be hung up on when it comes to rights negotiations. On the other hand, that's not an easy song to place. And yeah, so you're dealing with that. And then you're dealing with the constant danger that in the background, whoever you cast to play Jake is going to get older. And what the hell does that mean if you're looking at a 10-year production schedule? So like there's just a lot with this thing, and it makes it understandable, though I don't condone it, how you can make a decision to like do what they did with the movie and be like, well, we're just going to kind of blend a bunch of stuff later into now. And try to really radically adjust the chronology to make it more convenient. And the problem is that that comes at the cost of the integrity of the story. The fans are going to have a reaction, and we did. You know, it's really it's an incredible tightrope. But all to say, I hope this demonstrates that that I am thinking about it a lot.
He is working.
And working on it.
And I think you would also be safe to say that it's n this isn't a, because a lot of people, when they see something that they get excited about and then they don't hear anything about it for a couple of years, they just assume it's dead and nobody wants to admit it. But I think it's safe to say that this is a real deal thing with active development going on, correct?
Very much. And if the terrible day comes when it is dead, I'll be very honest about it. I wouldn't want to keep false hope alive. But I do want to keep real hope alive, because it's one of the things that gives these kind of projects the tailwind they need to actually happen. Because ultimately, the only thing a studio wants to know, because they're not going to understand the nuances of this, you know, the only thing they want to know is that there is an audience. And that's the thing about those comments. While they might, you know, while they might make me go like, oh, guys, come on, give me a break. You know, they are visible evidence that there is an audience, and that the audience is waiting, and that they don't have infinite patience. And that's all useful too. That's all useful for me. So, but yeah, I look forward to the comments when Chuck comes out. We'll see what the percentage is power.
It's all good. Well, we did get a note that we're approaching our wrap-up time here. So I want to circle back to Chuck one last time here before we end. And I think I want to get your, like, a kind of a before and after feeling from you, Mike. When you first picked up the novella and looked at it, what did you, I'm sure you like me, you Stephen, the way Stephen King writes is you can't help but picture the movie in your head as you're reading. So of course you had that. But what were your initial thoughts when you first picked it up, and now as you're sitting here on the eve of its coming out, I mean, with all the heaviness of the Wampler of it, and you know, and all that stuff, you know, wrapped into it. But like, where are you feeling? What are you feeling now, and what were you feeling then about the movie?
When I first put it down, I emailed Steve within an hour. And I said a dangerous thing. I said, if I get a chance with this and it looks anything like the movie in my head, it might be the best movie I ever make. And so I made a movie. You know, how much of that movie versus the one in your head is always kind of the struggle of this job. It's my favorite of any movie I've ever been involved in any capacity. I love it so much. I'm so grateful that I got to do it. It's a little miracle that we got to do it, frankly. I'm really glad that it exists, for my kids, which is one of the reasons I wanted to make it. Is it the best movie I'll ever make? Is it a movie that people, you know, are going to uniformly fall in love with? You know, I don't know. And we'll never know. But I'm deeply proud of what it is. It's exactly what I wanted it to be. And in a lot of ways, it is better than the movie that played in my head, because I never imagined what the dance really looked like until I saw it on the set. I never imagined Albie Krantz the way Mark Hamill brought it to life. You know, that wasn't in there. My whole cast, really. You know, I as much as I tried to imagine these characters, the cast exceeded anything I could have imagined in their rendering of them. So I've also had the delightful surprise of being able to watch parts of this movie for the first time, which doesn't often happen. So,
Man,
yeah.
listen, when you close your eyes, whether it's at night just to go to sleep or permanently, saying this is what I wanted is all that is really the goal, right? That's the goal, is to say this is what I got, what I wanted, not oh, I should have done this or I should have tried that. Like, there's obviously going to be frustration in life, but this is what I wanted. Is it got to be a good feeling?
It is. It's a wonderful feeling. I'll always have it for this movie, you know. And it's the neat thing about maybe the sad thing about these kind of every project. When they come out, they go away. They're not mine anymore. They belong to the audience. And so I've lived with it for years now. I've loved it every step of the way. And now it's off into the cosmos. It'll do whatever it's going to do without me now. And I'll be able to revisit it and enjoy it over the years, and always treasure the memories of making it. And to take it full circle, I'll never watch this without remembering bumping into you guys in the hotel lobby when you arrived, and then hanging out in the heat, in the sunlight, and sitting in the tent watching that dance over and over and over and over again. And yeah, I don't know. I love this thing. I hope other people do. I don't know how it'll go. They seem to like it a lot so far. So I'm optimistic that it was the right thing to make.
Well, that's a wonderful sentiment to end on. And I will say that the only thing that Scott hated more than traveling was sitting on a movie set, and the fact that he did both for you for that entire for 2 entire days. You remember he punked out on day three.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
He was just like he was like, nah, I'm just gonna stay in the hotel. You and Kels can go can go watch the studio stuff.
He's breaking continuity. What's
Yeah, like what the
that
well, no, he his stuff was done. He didn't have to be anywhere.
about?
This was just watching stuff. But that dude was so bored with being on a movie set, and the fact that he was so engaged for 2 whole days, like, should tell you all you need to know about how engaging the movie
Well,
was. So
Mike, I know you're venturing off to do to start Carrie. You're to start shooting
yeah,
soon,
2 weeks. Yeah.
Well, good luck. Can't wait to hear more about that when the time is right. But God bless. I know that's another passion project.
It's gonna be fun. But yeah, it's I'm sure we'll be talking about it quite a bit, because there's much in the King world to discuss there. It's gonna be a very different Carrie.
Oh,
Yeah.
interesting. Margaret
Oh
White, good guy now. You don't know.
yeah. Deeply sympathetic to Margaret this time.
Yes. Now it's the religious zealot was correct the whole time story.
Yep,
One of the
exactly.
Jewish.
This is the Chris Hargensen apology tour.
Chris did nothing wrong. Bullies forever. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, and we'll talk soon.
Take care,
Always
Mike.
great to see you both. Talk soon.
Bye.
Many thanks to Mike for the great chat and for, being so kind about, well, fucking everything. Good dude, that Mike Flanagan. Our Life of Chuck coverage does not end here. We have one more episode filled with guests from The Life of Chuck coming up next Wednesday. It's going to be a twofer. We have two different interviews that are going to be going back to back. We had about half an hour with each one, so we figured why not pair them up into one full-sized episode. And it just so happens to be with the two actors who Wampler and I ended up sharing the screen with in this movie. That is Miss Karen Gillan and, of course, Mr. Tom Hiddleston. Both of these are great chats. I'm very excited for y'all to hear them. And that'll be coming your way next Wednesday. In the meantime, I'll remind you that the very best way to support the show directly is to sign up for our Patreon over at patreon.com/thekingcast. There's a backlog of hundreds of episodes, of bonus episodes. You get your rowdy Discord. You get brand new bonus episodes delivered on the regular. In short, if you throw us a few bucks, we'll make it worth your while. There's lots and lots and lots of KingCast over there for you to listen to. So if you've never signed up for the Patreon, you've only really gotten about half the show. So if you like what you hear, throw us a few bucks, and you'll get instant access to all that stuff. Yeah, so that should do it for this extra special bonus episode, this Friday, the rare Friday KingCast episode. And we'll see you back next Wednesday for Karen Gillan and Tom Hiddleston. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.